So as we were sitting, I was reflecting on how, what better way to come together within the silence after the last week's difficulty. So tonight I was going to talk about the busy mind, but I decided to change it to Election 2016, the gateway to the Dharma. Because really, it's a really excellent time to practice. It's one of a few times in our lifetime that we have such a thing that comes up that triggers so much fear, reactivity, anger, sadness, grief, and it has such an intensity, but our practice can rise to meet it. In fact, this very quality of dukkha, of suffering, can be an important and vital gateway into the Dharma, into understanding. Really, it's a way to start to integrate our understanding of wisdom and compassion, to actually see how does this show up in the midst of when things aren't going the way that we wish. And this talk actually does assume that you are unhappy with the results. which isn't always a good assumption. You know, there's a way that we think we're all kind of like-minded. And it's one of the key things I want to explore later on in the talk, just that assumption of other and self, right? And how that very assumption creates some of the seeds for so much pain. But I won't speak from that assumption. And I also like to explore this topic with the framework of the grief process. Because I think a lot of people are feeling tremendous grief. I just was teaching in Cloud Mountain with Carrie, and we had a number of people who were processing the election, but also a number of people who were processing very personal losses, and just watching how they navigated that. And you can say, what does the grief process have to do with the Dharma? And really, when we quiet down, when we're still, if we're not resolved with our grief, it comes forth. It comes forth in worry and busyness, in grief, sadness, anger. And so learning to really work with our grief in a healthy way, in a full way, allows us to become much more fully present in the moment. The grief also shows us how we construct aspects of ourself. So the sense of self is a funneler, or what grief is really shaped by the sense of self. So it's a way to understand that in a deep way also. So these five stages of grief, of denial, of bargaining, of anger or fear, sadness, and acceptance, these five stages we cycle through. Sometimes they're very linear like that. Sometimes one comes up more out of order. And it's actually a process that we kind of cycle through them and we deepen in through that. Some of these stages you're going to have a natural affinity for, that I'm very familiar with, perhaps being sad or perhaps feeling that sense of denial. Other ones we're going to tend to have more of a sense of not really connecting with. I don't have that sense of anger, for example. You may feel a sense of resistance. So it's important on the one hand to really meet yourself where you are. You know, wherever you are in this process. And that also allows you to meet others where they are in the process. But notice where you feel that sense of resistance, where you, as we go through these five stages, which one you think, well, that doesn't really apply to me. And just file that away. Because at some point, it needs to be addressed, needs to be opened to. For us to fully grieve, to fully resolve it, we have to be able to open to all of these aspects, to go to this deep sense of acceptance and not a sense of a superficial acceptance. So each of these stages is healthy, is actually a natural process, and they're needed for the full recovery of grief. And there's a natural timing. You can have to trust that timing. And as I speak about these, I'm working through them too. It's not like it's a done thing. This grief does take time. So the first stage, denial. one of the interesting things, it's almost like a cosmic joke, because like many people, I thought it was very clear what the outcome of the election was going to be. Like I would have bet a lot of money on it, right? And then just the shock of it, it's like the mind just kind of rebels against that reality. There's this assumption that things would go a certain way, and it didn't. And it shows this kind of disorientation, this sense of shock, sense of not knowing really where the ground is. A sense of really being shaken. But in that moment of shaking, if you allow it to really be absorbed and be felt, there's a tremendous amount of wisdom in that. It's like when you lose someone, when someone dies that you care about, that first moment of hearing that they've died, when they've passed away, there's a point of quiet that comes up before the grief comes in, before the sadness in the story. There's a moment of, I don't quite know where I am in the world. The world is not the way I expected it to be. It's like a stopping of our normal, continual illusion of permanence. You know, we go through life really expecting things to be a certain way. We're constantly doing that. It's kind of shoring up the underlying reality of impermanence, of insubstantiality. The things are always in flux. So we're always creating this sense that life is actually more continuous. And things like the election, things like a loss, it interrupts that. It's like a break in that. And at first we panic and there's a sense of quite a bit of dis-ease with that. But if we allow ourselves to be still in that, it's actually very accessible even in the midst of meditation. When you allow yourself to be very still, there's not a sense of leaning into trying to focus on the breath, trying to focus on a sensation, but simply being very available to what's arising moment after moment, and each moment falls away. And so that sense of stillness becomes actually a refuge, because something that you actually orient more and more toward. And there's times when the whole, or at least half of the country, resonates with that sense of, okay, things are very in not the way we expected. So the sense of denial, often in terms of grieving, there's a sense things are too much to take in. This fact is too much to hold in this moment. So there's kind of a sense of checking out, a sense of distancing from it, kind of the deer in the headlights experience. And again, this is healthy. And there's a point of, we have to accommodate often to grief in a gradual way, in a gentle way. And this is a way of kind of slowing down that process, just denying things have happened. So denial. The next stage is bargaining. You know, sometimes you can think of it as arguing with the fact, negotiation, rationalization. And this is actually the first, I actually went into this after the sense of shock. It's kind of like, well, he can't be that bad. And there's a sense of rationalization about, you know, partly it's my natural optimism, and partly it's my not reading a lot of news and being a little blissfully ignorant, my limited media news diet. So there's that sense of just kind of putting a positive spin on things, trusting that people will do the right thing. Now, it could be these are true, but the way I was approaching it was a way of distancing from the feeling that was underneath the grief itself, the sense of sadness, the sense of fear, going into the sense of making a story, making myself feel more secure. See, that moment of breaking, of the sense of permanence, when we realize things aren't so permanent, very quickly we fill it in with making the story, arguing about that point, trying to make things feel better. And usually talk to people about it. You have find some people who have that kind of approach, and they're kind of in that sense of intellectualizing it. So as it feels like a heady space, kind of escaping into the world of thought. And it's really avoiding this pain of reality. Now, as I say that, it's easy to come in and judge that. It's like, that's not good. I shouldn't be doing that. Again, this is a natural stage. It's a natural way for the mind and heart to accommodate into loss, into disappointment. So being patient with it. You know, I mean, trusting that, okay, this is a natural part of grief. In some ways, an essential part. Because until we start to bargain or start to, you know, see, isn't there some way I can get around this? Maybe we should go back to the popular vote, or maybe the Russians were involved, or there's kind of all these stories we might come up with trying to argue the fact of this reality. And it's part of that we have to argue and able to relax into it, to finally accept it. So after bargaining, we often go into anger or fear. So you can think of anger and fear as being two sides of the same coin. You know, anger is this kind of more forceful outward pushing away. Fear is more the scared running away. But really, neurologically, evolutionarily, it's the same process. Sometimes we fight the tiger, and sometimes we run away from the tiger. I'd like to just acknowledge, too, that as a white male, I'm not as personally attacked as by some of the president-elect's stance of being in the world. You know, having a wife and having a young daughter, I just become much more attuned to so much pain there is in this culture for women. Really going beyond our culture, all the way back probably to the point we decided that God wasn't a woman. So there's this constant, it's almost we swim in this sea of oppression and judgment and violence often. And so for as individuals, when someone in such a high place of authority says something, it dings not only our cultural pain around that, but our personal pain if we've experienced abuse and hurt more directly. And even if we haven't, we swim in that sea. So it's really, it's not a small thing. And the same thing with many people of color in this, perhaps all people of color in this country, that there's histories of oppression that's kind of this built-in assumption of less than, that they are always dealing with, always fighting with, of prejudice, of rage, of violence, of immigrants, Muslims, any non-American. All these groups of people, I can see that the fear can be very much more acute, because it's not only touching to the present moment fear, but all this past fear. So being very gentle with this, being very kind with this. Perhaps part of this fear that seems so gripping for people, some people are in almost a panic about how bad they think things will be. Part of it's a sense of powerlessness, that you don't have, there's something that's much, the big authority has come in and tells you what you can be or can't be, what you can do, forcing you into doing things. A sense of profound helplessness. And really the president is one of the greatest authority figures we have. And as many people have, there's authority figure wounding. There's issues around our fathers, around our teachers. People who we've held in high, who've been in high places over us, have often not held that role very kindly. You know, so there's a sense of we like the president, he's a good dad, we don't like the president, a bad dad. And that digs all these really deep, archaic pieces. And apparently we're not quite ready for having a good mom and a bad mom yet. Hopefully soon. Now, there's such projection into the future. So there's all this historic pain that's very real, that's very valid, that we carry. There's the statements that have happened. There's the actions of some members of the country, which are very, you know, very sad, very scary. And there's also the whole projection into the future of how things will get, you know, how bad things will get, instead of making meaning of things. There's a story that Sharon Salzberg shares. I was teaching with my colleague Joseph Goldstein when a student came to see him in great distress. The man said he had just had a terrible experience. He was meditating, felt tension in his jaw, and suddenly realized what an uptight person he is, how he can't get close to anyone, and that he's going to be alone for the rest of his life. You mean you felt some tension in your jaw, Joseph said. The man continued with his projections. He said he was pretty sure he'd always be tense, he'd never change, he felt hopeless. You mean you felt some tension in your jaw, Joseph said. I watched the man continue barreling down this path of misery for some time, all because of a sore jaw, until finally Joseph said, you're having a painful experience. Why are you adding a horrible self-image to it? So what has happened? A certain person has been elected. Right? That's painful for many of us. You know, very painful. But how do we have to keep adding more to that? You know, in a year or 2 years when we have a different thing to talk about? But right now, it's mostly imagined. It's mostly projected out into the future. So this... A huge advantage for meditators, I've been noticing in my own practice, my professional practice, I have some people who are meditators and how they have a certain stability in the midst of this crisis. And other people who don't are caught in this sheer panic. It's like their fears and their emotions and their thoughts all come together and create this huge story. And they become more and more worked up. And it's extremely difficult. So learning how to increase our capacity for holding the difficult is such an essential part of our practice. Because really from our own, you know, there's been many studies showing how our brains are really wired to notice what's wrong in the world, what's dangerous in the world. That's what we pay attention to. Because evolutionary, we lasted longer if we jumped every time we heard a little rustle in the branch in the grass than if we were just busy smelling flowers. Right? Noticing what was dangerous or potentially dangerous and reacting to it allowed us to pass on our genes. So we have this kind of inherited process of almost paranoia or really noticing what's dangerous, what's wrong. And we project that in all kinds of things, our own self-image, how we take other people to be, and it triggers this deep biasing. So learning to expand the focus can be very helpful to notice. You know, often I think about when I first started practice or before I practiced, when bad things happen, they'd be so all-consuming. And now when bad things happen, they're very intense. But there's a bigger picture that's held in the moment. You know, I can expand to feel my feet touching the floor, while before that was completely inaccessible. I can connect with the sense of the sky or the wind touching my cheek, as well as the emotional pain I might be going through or the physical pain. So that sense of broadening our attention helps to stabilize our attention. Because if we don't broaden that, we tend to get very tight with the way we're attending, the way we're seeing. It's like we're a moth to the flame that just keeps going closer and closer. So the sense of reconnecting with the body, as I spoke about the last talk, with the worried mind, is so essential. Making the body a refuge that you can keep coming back to, that can be a place of grounding, a place of stability, calling you back into this present moment's experience. And still, there's things to do. There's concerns to address. There's plans to be made. And the body is also a grounding of this moment. Just this moment. Often with things like anger and with fear, there's such a focus on the object, what we're angry toward or who we're angry about, or our fear of that experience or that person. So as a meditator, we start to learn to shift from the object to the process. What does the actual process of anger feel like? So it's like a shift. You can think of it as a gaze, like you actually shift, if you're driving, if you weren't driving, if you're a passenger, let's say, and you're looking outside down the road, where are you going? Okay, I want to get to that exit. If you shift instead to the sense of being in the car, what does that actually feel like? The sense of the car turning, the car accelerating, the car slowing down. That's the same shift from the object that we want to do something about, fight with it, run away from it, to the actual experience of wanting to, that impulse. So it goes from action to impulse. Now that allows us to slow things down and not be so reactive. It actually allows us to be much more responsive. When we're responsive, we can be much more skillful, much more appropriate. With metta, we often consider that as one of the most significant antidotes to fear and to ill will. Now, metta is often kind of seen as a secondary practice. I guess Ajahn Amaro was saying we think of it as a after-dinner mint. So like the end of the retreat, we give you like a little something to help, you know, cleanse your palate. Yet metta, if you really understand metta, it's actually imbued through all the practice. We say, no, don't just pay attention, but pay attention in a kind way, in almost an affectionate way, a sense of softness, a sense of allowing into the moment's experience. I mean, for myself, metta always seemed to be, I never quite connected with it. It felt like digging a ditch in the hot New Mexico sun, which I did as a teenager. And just thought, okay, may I be happy, you know, may I be safe. And I just felt, I did not like it. I was adverse to it. And it just seemed like it wasn't very helpful. Then one day, my wife was in the hospital with a very acute illness, acute condition that required an ER visit. It was the kind of condition that you had to wait for an expert to come in and give a prognosis or a diagnosis. So there's a lot of time kind of waiting in the little ER room. And of course, these things happen late at night when you're tired. And at that point in time, we had a young daughter she's still young, but she was 7. And there's just this fear of what will happen in the future. What's going to happen? That poem from Naomi Shihab Nye, when you feel the future dissolve in a moment like salt in a weakened broth, that kept coming back to me because there's this idea that, okay, things would go a certain way. And that was all thrown into doubt, into question, just like the election. And so I tried, being a good meditator, try to connect with my breath and my body. And it was like dropping water on a hot skillet. It would just sputter right off. No sense of connecting, no sense of penetrating beyond that hot surface of my experience. Because there was anger toward the staff, impatience, there was deep concern for my wife, fear for my daughter, fear for myself. And I thought, okay, metta, maybe I should try metta. And metta allowed me through that intentionality, the intention of well-wishing, allowed me to connect with that moment's experience. May she be safe. May she be healthy. May I be safe and happy. May the staff be safe and happy. And so that sense of yoking intentionality with well-wishing, really the intention of well-wishing, allowed me to connect with that moment, to actually go through this. So when fear really comes up, come back to that sense of metta. I mean, the Buddha would have, there's stories of monks who would go into the woods and be scared of the ghost and evil spirits. And the Buddha would say, go back there and do metta. You know, prove to yourself that metta is this lion's roar of compassion, of strength. Metta has this quality of being impersonal. It's such an interesting paradox because it can touch really deep pain, deep concern that feels so personal and so meaningful for ourselves. But because it is impersonal, it's able to hold it. You know, as we do metta in a formal way, we go through all categories of beings, friends, benefactors, neutral people, difficult people, because the message is that metta covers all those people without exception, without preference. So fear and anger. Again, a very natural part And often these two, especially anger, when grief kind of gets interrupted, anger is something that's not so addressed. So it can be very helpful when we're grieving to spend some time voicing, expressing how we're angry. Maybe writing a letter to that loved one. It's hard when you've lost someone, but to, you know, I'm mad that you're no longer with me. I'm mad about these things that you've done. In the sense of anger with the election, if you're not happy about it. So the next quality, the next stage is sadness. This actual sadness. Now sadness, when it's really purely felt, when we're fully experienced, it's quite healing. And a number of people told me that they just sobbed when they heard that. And my wife was sobbing. And that sense of just deep, you know, hearing that news and just that sense of just breaking down and feeling that so purely, so clearly. You know, grief is such a huge part of being human. Buddha talked about if you knew all the tears that you had shed over all your lifetimes, it would fill all the oceans. You know, so we live through this life with a sense of deep sorrow. And I would like to read that full poem, Kindness. I read it a lot, and I really like it, so I hope you bear with me. So, kindness. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment, like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved. All this must go so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too is someone who traveled through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness is the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it until your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, it is I you have been looking for. Then goes with you everywhere like a shadow or a friend. So don't rush the sense of sadness, the sense of feeling that sorrow. Letting yourself feel the size of the cloth, as Naomi Shihab Nye speaks of. This is helping us to really understand directly this first noble truth of suffering, of dukkha, that there is dukkha in life. That deep understanding of dukkha, that not an intellectual, but just really knowing it in your bones, becomes the seed for the whole path to unfold. To see what is the cause of this dukkha, what is the end of the dukkha, what is the path to the end of the dukkha. Now grief, or the sense of quality of sadness, often it becomes very difficult because the story of the sadness gets mixed in and we can really contract it. So when you feel yourself contracting around the sadness, again, go back to that sense of broadening the gaze, like physically looking at nature, looking in a broader way. It's a sense of opening it up, sharing that grief with other people, writing about it. It helps if being so contracted, so tight. And when grief or sadness continues without really fully being expressed and getting stuck, it can change into this sense of depression, often by not feeling the anger or fear that we have underneath. So now we move to acceptance. So jumping to acceptance prematurely is a form of spiritual bypassing. that, you know, I'm over that, I can understand, this is just how things are. You know, that was kind of a dialogue. But true acceptance requires a deep feeling of all these qualities of the shock, the denial, the bargaining, the fear and anger, the sadness. At IMS, if you've ever been there, there's a loop that you can walk, a 3-mile loop. And this is such an old part of the country that there's farmers who have built these rock walls. But the rock walls were actually came from the soil of the field. So they would go through and tilling the soil, and they'd pull out these rocks and start to make the fence. The next winter, more rocks would come up from the frost heap, and they would pick out more rocks. So the soil, over time, would become much more fertile and smooth and gentle, easy to plow through. I think of grief in that way. That grief happens, we lose something, and there's this initial kind of tilling the soil. We get the rocks out. But then often we forget that there's more rocks that are underneath the surface that will continue to come up. And so grief requires a sense of patience and perseverance to keep coming back to see what new rock has come up. And treating it gently, kindly, saying, okay, what does this rock need to be heard, to be met with? And then it's allowed to put aside. I learned this really when I was young. I had my first marriage. It only lasted for like 3 years. But this process as I was going through the divorce, there was tremendous grief coming up. And so I made this tape of all the songs that triggered different parts of the grief. The anger, the sadness, the heartbreak, the fear, the acceptance. And I would just keep listening to that tape and give myself permission just to sob and to cry. And then, you know, okay, I feel good. And then I listen to it again, and more tears would come up. And so I did this over a 6-month or a year period. And that retilling the soil allowed that grief to be much more fully processed. So give yourself permission to be patient with this, to be patient with the grief. And it's important to realize that this grief, if you were experiencing grief from this election, is also calling forth all the other unfelt grief. You know, I was talking to a Sangha member this morning, or just right before we started, and just her history of looking at, you know, this president got assassinated, this Martin Luther King got assassinated, and these wars, and all these accumulated grief of this country that she had lived through, and here's another piece. Right? And so when it feels like it's overwhelming, it's often that some of our grief hasn't been fully tended to. So use this opportunity to tend to your grief. A therapist we kind of worked with had a book called Good Grief, in the sense of good grieving, deeply grieving. Now to how do we do this process of allowing the grief to deepen? We need time, we need space, we need to create a sense of permission to set aside the need to act temporarily. So I can just really focus on this experience of grieving. And how to keep kind of chilling that, to bring forth that grief, you have to be a little careful with this day and age, because the news media may not be the best option. It's like if you listen to it, you find more things you even realize to be worried about. It's like there's this papancha of worry that we're just kind of, at least the liberal press and progressive press just gets building more and more on. So taking news fast, being very careful about, you know, what input do I have, but finding other ways to really connect with that grief, to help it just be, see, where am I with this? Where am I with this? Talking with friends, you know, coming like what Tweri did on Saturday was a beautiful expression of sharing what was on your heart, what was going through. Grief isn't a linear process. It jumps around. Some places become more predominant. We open one some level and then another one comes forth. So there's a sense of trusting the process. At the same time, there's also noticing when there's a sense, of resistance, a sense of, I don't really want to go toward the anger. I don't want to go toward the fear. And just realizing, okay, that needs to be turned to at some point. Now, learning to tend to our own grief allows us to be much more present and to tend toward others' grief. You know, it's so essential, including the ones who hold a different a belief system than us, a different structure of how they see the world. So we have this assumption that everyone in Seattle was really disappointed. Where I live up in Snohomish County, I found out, we went to bed before the election results were full, were finally through. We found out because of gunshots and fireworks. People were celebrating. They were very excited. Not everybody, but a very vocal subgroup. You know, so we look at Washington, we think of it all blue, but really 38% of people voted for Trump. 38% of people. All right. So what do we do with that fact? One of my colleagues was commenting that he felt like this was like post 9/11, the sense of being in shock. You know, the same kind of things are coming up for him after that terrorist attack. And one of the things that came up for me after that attack and also has come up here is that sense of wanting to understand the other point of view. Really wanting to understand that. What perspective are they coming from? You know, realizing that I don't understand it because I just assumed it was a no-brainer. I'm talking about the majority of good people, not the ones who are doing the hate crimes, attacking people. Not that's something that's completely different that should not be tolerated. But there's this other large group of people who the election was really, they're very happy about the results. So to do that, am I willing to release my point of view long enough to take in that other side? Am I willing to set aside my belief structure? Tori was talking about this last time she was talking or teaching about her kids, her boys, and when they would argue some point, her rule was, okay, you have to now argue the other point of view. You had to step out of your perspective enough to be really hear the other side, to really be passionate about it. At some point, laughter would happen because they realized it was all kind of ridiculous, that they were both, you know, it's just positions that we get caught in. So there's a sense of trust that has to happen, especially when things are so charged, this willingness that if I set aside my views and my opinions, I won't forget them. I won't like become brainwashed. Okay, can I set aside enough to really let things in? To understand, it's often a classic reflection is, just as I wish to be happy, so you too wish to be happy. Just as you wish to avoid suffering, just as I wish to avoid suffering, so to you. So reflecting on that's a core human motivation, regardless of how you voted or how you act. There's this deep wanting to be happy. You know, we feel disappointment, fear, anxiety. They feel excitement. They feel this sense of longing and hope at last. And this thing was reversed the last two elections. You know, we live on this plane of gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute, pain and pleasure. We will always be disappointed at some point. If we're willing to let go of our agenda and our ideas and concepts enough to really listen, we'll find that we become transformed by that. And then we can come back and pick up that same agenda and actually be completely transformed and informed. We can actually be much more effective in our actions and how we speak to the other side. So we stop seeing them as the other. Because really, what makes their side wrong and our side right? You could say, well, it's fundamental values, the ethics, sense of ethics. You could say it's a sense of priorities. Ultimately, it's belief and thought. It's the belief and thought. They just believe different thoughts than we do. Right? So this is a much deeper perspective. It's going to this more absolute sense of how things are. We start to see beyond the duality of thought being good and bad, that we hold thought itself as being equally valid. It's a much difficult, more. It takes a lot of practice and insight to really see this. So some ways we can work with seeing the other side. So my mother, who's here tonight, she was watching my daughter at an election night because I was teaching. I came back and she was just kind of in shock. The next day, she had to ride the bus to school to volunteer at my daughter's school. And she happened to be waiting at the bus stop and struck up this conversation with someone who was very happy about the results. You know? And so she said, well, tell me about that. And so they talked. And she really understood a different perspective, that from this veteran, he was concerned about the VA and just the difficulty, and he really liked the idea that he could call up the White House if things weren't going right. So there's that sense of really connecting with that perspective. And it was a beautiful example of how we can really connect. So when you talk to people, don't assume right away that they're unhappy. You may be surprised how many people are not, that who are happy about things. And if you feel up to it, start talk to them. Say, you know, tell me about your hopes, your dreams, what you're dissatisfied with, what you're angry about. Yeah. Trusting that will actually deepen your understanding. You know, playing with trying the opposite view on, like Tuareg's process with her children. I thought about how would I give this talk if to the red states, if Clinton had won. Let's say I was in a different part. Because you know, the Dharma isn't just for liberals or progressives. We assume it is, though, right? But really, does it transcend that? You know, how would I be talking if you were a bunch of Trump supporters who were really upset that Clinton had won? I'd be talking about essentially the same things. The same things. The same fear would be coming up. Maybe a different flavor of the fear or what the outcome would be. But there'd be fear, there'd be anger, there'd be grief and sadness. The same core concerns. You know, play with considering, once if Trump does a good job? You know, how would you feel? Can you actually allow him to perhaps do some good? Just can you allow that Obama did some bad? We get so selective in our sense of looking at things. That's why I love the concession, thank you. Just, you know, it was like this encouragement, okay, to work with him, help him do the best job. Obama did the same thing. Another way to look at it is to find the common ground, the ground that we both try stand on. You know, a beautiful example of this is the Camp David Accords back in 78. Egypt and Israel were just at war, had fought three wars over territory. You know, is this your land or my land? And President Carter had the two leaders come to Camp David. And they just got to this impasse where they weren't able to go anywhere. And he took one aside and he said, let me show you some pictures of my grandchildren. So they're looking at the grandchildren. And Carter said, you know, this is who it's about. It's not about us. It's about our children and our grandchildren. And that reframing became the common ground that they were able to connect with and make a peace accord that has lasted to this day, that's never been violated. Just as you wish to be happy, they too wish to be happy. So how our own grief is dealt with affects all other griefs, and how we respond to the expression of grief. And when we fully feel our grief and really work with it, acknowledge it, then we can act. It becomes this incredibly powerful ground to act from, to move outward from. Just as unresolved grief becomes a place of division. Yeah, that sense of when grief isn't fully felt, it perpetuates this sense of duality. Our hate grows stronger. Like we have such a system of huge shifting of tides. It's like a kind of a bipolar, manic depressant system. If we could somehow find that place of unity so we don't go so far to one side to another, where one side is heartbroken, thrown into despair, anger, and fear, the other side is thrown into hope and excitement. anticipation. It's important to see that when I demonize another group, I'm essentially demonizing an aspect of myself. When I create a sense of hatred in myself, it's really within my own heart. That's where the damage is that sense of hatred is really a self-damaging thing. This is why the heart of metta transcends the personal, transcends the differences. So once you've kind of worked with the grief, when you've tilled that soil, put your heart into really what matters for you, what brings your heart alive, where the good in the world that you see that you really want to enhance. Mr. Rogers is famous for talking about his mother, and whenever there was a disaster, his mother would say, "Look at all the people around the surface, around the center of it, that are helping. When you see the helpers, you know there's still hope." So, you know, allow yourself to see the helpers, to join the helpers, to act on what you value, what you can do. And in a little bit, we'll be acknowledging a group of people who've really done that at this center, at SIMS, who really committed sometimes a little bit of time, sometimes a tremendous amount of time, to supporting us in our practice, this practice of connecting with our hearts, of learning to be present in the moment, to deepen into the Buddha's wisdom. So let's just sit quietly for a moment or two. Okay, thank you. So we'll have a discussion about this topic next week with homework. So it'll be a chance to have much more of a dialogue around it. But I probably have a chance for maybe one or two questions if there's anything that's like to be expressed. Yes, thank you. Yes. But that's what triggered it. So the comment is about where she's now is, why do we have to be the bigger people that always are listening and asking, how are you doing, instead of the other side doing the same? Yeah, so, I mean, that particular story, I kind of edited it quite a bit. There was already kind of a rapport about something that wasn't election related. And you know, and my mom that's how she is. But, but yes, I would challenge you to question that a little bit, because, you know, I come across people who are not that way, and they actually do ask, you know, and there's that kind of that awkward thing, like, do I say how I'm really feeling, you know, that kind of a quality. There's some who don't care, and there's some on the other side who don't care. So it's like there's, at some point, one of us has to be willing to say, you know, tell me how you're doing. It's like when my wife and I get into a difficulty, I'm laughing because she's here. At some point, one of us has to be willing to say, well, tell me how you're feeling. You know, and it's like, it's hard to do that. And it may be that, you know, progressives are more skilled at that, but I don't know if I would necessarily say that as a blanket statement. So, you know, question that, you know, see if that's really true. I think there's some really good-hearted people out there who just, you know, they have a very different, you know, hierarchy of needs, things that they really are concerned about, and things which don't match up for our concern. Doesn't mean that our concerns are better or worse. So And just challenge that a little bit and see. Yes. Sure.
I feel very protective of, you know, like you're saying, as a white man, I'm a white, straight woman.
Right.
I feel very hurt for my friends of color and my gay friends.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I'm maybe sometimes in a better position to stand up to others.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So
the question is about feeling this sense of protection toward, gay friends or people of color because she's a white female and that she's in a better position to do that. Where does that fit in with the grieving process? I would say it's kind of going on into the action of it. You know, so it's fine to, it's not like you have to wait till I'm all done with grieving before you start to act. If there's an urge to act, then act. You know, if there's an urge to stand up, I think that's really essential. Is to stand up and speak when you can. And it's true that you can tread in places that others can't. There's kind of an allowance that's given you because of your characteristics and demographics. And to use that for good, too. I think that's, you know, it's like there's citizens who are doing harm, and there's, I think, a lot more citizens who can stand up and do good. Yeah. All right, I'd love to hear more questions, and next week we can do that. But we need to move on to volunteer appreciation.